Welcome once again to our course on United States Catholic History. We concluded the last episode with the period of Reconstruction in U.S. history, and now we're going to open this one by talking about the Gilded Age, the 1880s and 1890s, the final two decades of the 19th century, the era of James Cardinal Gibbons. Why the era of Cardinal Gibbons? Because he was the most towering figure in the Catholic Church in the United States, not only in the final two decades of the 19th century, but really until his death in 1921. And he was such a towering figure that it is under the tutelage of Cardinal Gibbons, if you will, that many historians say the Church in America came of age. Monsignor Peter Gilday of Philadelphia, who was himself a very prominent church historian, has studied these final 20 years, and he makes this comment, speaking of Cardinal Gibbons. In a sense, writes Monsignor Gilday, the history of the Church in the United States in these years and down to our own day is largely a biography of his episcopate. Such a towering figure, then, was James Cardinal Gibbons. Well, who was this young man, James Gibbons, and what was he about? James Gibbons was born in the city of Baltimore in 1834. As a youngster, we are told that his parents took him to a parade in downtown Baltimore, in which he saw General Andrew Jackson waving to the crowds. And in the course of the 87 years that he would live his life in this world, he had the recollection of Andrew Jackson as a young boy, and he knew personally all of the prominent men in political and religious life down to 1921. So his life spanned many, many years and many people indeed. He was born in Baltimore, but he returned to Ireland, where his parents were natives, when he was just a young child. The family were not back in Ireland too many years when the elder Gibbons, the father, Thomas, died in Ballinrobe in County Mayo. And to this day, you can go to the little village of Partree, which is very close to Ballinrobe. You can see the iron fence surrounding the grave of Thomas Gibbons, and you can read an inscription on the front of the iron fence. Affectionately presented by the very Reverend James Gibbons, Vicar Apostolic of North Carolina. Imagine he presented that in his early career in the church, and the monument is still intact in that little village in Ireland today. Well, James Gibbons lived in Ireland, and he came back and was ordained a priest of New Orleans in 1861. He rose rapidly in the church, and he became, as we say, the Vicar Apostolic of North Carolina as quite a young man. When James Gibbons went to North Carolina, and of course the area he was presiding over was naturally the whole state of North Carolina, he found no more than 1,000 Catholics scattered around the entire state. He found just a very few churches, and the churches were a considerable distance apart. So he was a real missionary in the true sense of the word. But the North Carolina years are really remembered for something more than just missionary activity on the part of the young Father Gibbons. One day, in the sacristy of a church in North Carolina, he was talking to a fellow priest, and the fellow priest said to him, "You know, people really don't understand the faith. Something ought to be written to explain the Catholic faith to them in its entirety." James Gibbons thought that was quite a good idea, and he decided that he would write a book, and the book he wrote was a phenomenal bestseller. It was called The Faith of Our Fathers. What was it? It was a defense of the Catholic faith, a thorough explanation of what Catholics believe, and it did a tremendous amount in the years after its publication to break down prejudice against Catholics in the United States. It has been reprinted and reprinted and reprinted, and to this day, very frequently, you can go into Catholic bookstores and you will see there a copy of The Faith of Our Fathers by the very Reverend James Gibbons, Vicar Apostolic of North Carolina. He went on to become the Bishop of Richmond, Virginia, and he would spend 5 years in the former Confederate capital. Then he returned to his native city of Baltimore, where he succeeded James Roosevelt Bailey as Archbishop. Now, what did James Gibbons do that made him such a success story? Well, his most prominent biographer, Monsignor John Tracy Ellis, who was at the Catholic University of America for many years, said that the greatness of James Gibbons did not lie in the fact that he was an original thinker. So he was not necessarily an intellectual. He was a tremendous synthesizer of other people's thoughts. He was a man of great foresight. He was a skilled diplomat, and he was a very holy individual. What did he do in the course of his episcopacy in Baltimore? He presided over the Third Plenary Council. He recommended the establishment of the Catholic University of America. He was very instrumental in having the apostolic delegation created in Washington so that the Holy Father would have a personal representative in this country. He very actively supported the National Catholic Welfare Conference during the First World War. He was a friend of governors and senators and presidents, and yet he was a friend of the most common man who walked the streets of Baltimore. That's really what made James Gibbons great. He was as friendly to the most common person in Baltimore as he was to the highest representatives of government. Is it any wonder that Theodore Roosevelt, his close friend, could refer to Cardinal Gibbons as the civus primus, the first citizen of the United States? Probably his greatest accomplishment, and the one that he himself would have wanted to be remembered for the most, was the fact that he was able to secure church approval for an organization called the Noble Order of the Knights of Labor. Now, the Knights of Labor in the 19th century were, I think we can say, the forerunners of the American Federation of Labor in the 20th century. They were the one massive labor organization, and they were headed by an individual, a Grand Master workman, by the name of Terence Vincent Powderly. Terence V. Powderly was himself a Roman Catholic, and he would work in close cooperation with Cardinal Gibbons to try to secure church approval for the Knights of Labor. Why didn't the church like the Knights of Labor? Well, because they were a secret society. They had secret passwords and keywords and secret rituals, we are told, and the church was very, very skeptical. What was going on? After all, most of the members of the Knights of Labor were Roman Catholics. They were working men, and they were attending these secretive meetings. And the church was very skeptical as to what the Knights of Labor were all about. So Cardinal Gibbons had Terence V. Powderly of Carbondale, Pennsylvania, and later mayor of Scranton, Pennsylvania, come and address the national hierarchy of the United States. And Powderly apparently did a successful job in convincing the bishops of the country that the Knights of Labor were secretive only because they did not want industry to know what went on at their meetings. They were not disloyal Catholics. They were not saying anything that the church would not approve or would not accept. They simply wanted their meetings in secrecy so that their deliberations could be their deliberations and no one else's. Well, once Powderly had succeeded in convincing the American hierarchy what went on with the Knights of Labor, and after he and Cardinal Gibbons had done their job as thoroughly as they did, then Cardinal Gibbons took the case to Rome. And he was able, through his own personal diplomacy in Rome, to succeed to convince the Vatican that there was nothing inherently wrong in the Noble Order of the Knights of Labor, and he won church approval. In other words, the church said, yes, Catholics could, in good conscience, belong to the Knights of Labor and work for their own common good. Not only did Cardinal Gibbons secure church approval for the Noble Order of the Knights of Labor, but when he went over to Rome for these negotiations, we will never know exactly what he said or who he influenced, but it was not terribly long afterwards that Pope Leo XIII wrote his very famous encyclical Rerum Novarum. That has been hailed for decades and decades as a landmark papal encyclical in which the rights of labor and capital are clearly delineated by the Pope himself. Cardinal Gibbons most assuredly played a part in the writing of that famous encyclical Rerum Novarum. Is it any wonder then Cardinal Gibbons would go down in history as a great champion of the laboring man? So his influence was all pervasive now, particularly in these final decades of the 19th century. These were years, too, when immigration was transforming American Catholicism as it had in the past. In earlier years, we talked about immigrants coming from Northern Europe and from Western Europe. Now, in these final decades of the 20th century, we find immigrants coming from Eastern Europe. We have the Polish, we have the Hungarians, we have the various Slavic groups. Over 1 million Catholics were pouring into the United States each and every year in the decades from 1880 to 1920, so that Catholics were becoming a tremendous segment of the American population. The Irish, you still found here in the East. The Germans you found in the Midwest in areas like Cincinnati, St. Louis, Milwaukee. The Italians, primarily here in the East, trying to recreate the same village atmosphere here that they had known in Italy. And then other nationalities were quick to follow. The Lithuanians, the Bohemians, the Slovaks, the Croats, the Slovenes, the Hungarians. They all began piling into the United States in the late 19th century, and they were all, of course, Catholic immigrants. Among the Italians, we would certainly want to single out the magnificent contributions of Mother Frances Xavier Cabrini. She and her missionary Sisters of the Sacred Heart came to America in 1889 to teach, to work in hospitals, and to care for the young Italian immigrants who were almost daily pouring into the United States. As we know so well, Mother Cabrini was the first citizen of our country to be declared a canonized saint of the Church. You had Canadian immigration pouring into New England. You had Portuguese immigration coming into Massachusetts, particularly the Portuguese from the Azores, who came to the area of Fall River, Massachusetts, and engaged in deep-sea fishing, as they had in the Azores as well. As the Church began to grow and began to develop, the faith was getting more vibrant, was getting more strong. Parochial schools were growing and developing. Release time instruction for public school children was becoming stronger. And whether you went to public school or whether you went to parochial school, in these years of the 80s and 90s, you were trained, you were inculcated with the Baltimore Catechism, that magnificent question and answer way to learn our religion in which the powers of memory Through our powers of memory, we were able to absorb the magnificent truths of faith. And the faith was spread through journalism as well. Ave Maria magazine was published by the Holy Cross Fathers at the University of Notre Dame. The Messenger of the Sacred Heart was put out by the Jesuits. The Catholic World was put out by the Paulists. Organizations began to grow and develop, altar and rosary societies, holy name societies. The Knights of Columbus were begun in 1882 in New Haven, Connecticut, by the saintly Father Michael McGivney. Temperance societies really, really began to take off and grow and develop. The Knights of Father Matthew, named for Father Theobald Matthew, the Irish Apostle of Temperance, who came to this country and who personally administered that famous pledge to so many Irish immigrants. Temperance societies were very, very active on the diocesan level, on the state level, and certainly on the national level. We have here a program from a temperance convention that was held in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania in 1905. To this particular gathering came the President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. He was invited there by the Bishop of the Diocese of Scranton, Michael J. Hoban. And it's interesting, on the back of this program, this original souvenir program, if we look, what do we find? We find the pledge that was taken by all of the Knights of Father Matthew. I pledge, with the divine assistance to abstain from all intoxicating drinks. Now, there's a great deal of humor about the temperance movement, but believe me, to many of these Irish immigrants, this was no joke at all. It was a very, very serious commitment. So there were many societies growing, many groups developing. In 1872, believe it or not, a Roman Catholic ran for President of the United States. His name was Charles O'Connor, and he ran on a splinter Democratic ticket. In 1872, the President of the United States was Ulysses S. Grant, and he was running for re-election, and not that many people were very, very happy with the Grant scandals and corruption. So they decided that they would not vote for Grant, but they would vote for Horace Greeley, who was the liberal Republican challenging Grant for the nomination. Until a lot of things came out about Greeley, and people didn't like him either. So this Catholic lawyer in New York City, Charles O'Connor, decided to run for president. Charles O'Connor's name appeared on the ballot in 26 states, and he received several hundred thousand votes. While he was not the formal nominee, he was the nominee of a splinter group of the Democrat Party. Joseph McKenna became the Attorney General of the United States under President William McKinley. Edward Douglas White of Louisiana became the second Roman Catholic to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Catholics were making fortunes, people like Thomas Fortune Ryan in New York, or William R. Grace, who became the first Catholic mayor of New York City of the Grace Shipping Line fame. The Cudahy brothers, who made their fortune in the meatpacking industry. Or John McKay, whose interests ranged anywhere from the Nevada steel or silver mines to the transatlantic cable. You have other Catholics distinguishing themselves in very different ways. For example, Father Edward McGlynn in New York. He was a great devotee of Henry George. Now, Henry George was the fellow who gave us the single tax theory. Henry George said that the only thing we ought to tax in this country is the value, is one flat tax on land. Not on property at all, just on land values. If you did that, then you encouraged home building. If you encouraged home building, you put people to work and so forth. Henry George was considered very, very socialistic in his day. And Father Edward McGlynn in New York was a strong proponent of his and went to battle for him when Henry George ran for mayor of New York City. And the Archbishop of New York, Michael Corrigan, said, listen, if any Catholic in the Diocese of New York attends a lecture by Father Edward McGlynn, you are committing a very serious sin. Well, Henry George did not win the mayoralty election in New York City, and Father Edward McGlynn's fame fizzled out, and he spent the rest of his days quietly as a pastor in the Hudson River town of Newburgh, New York. You also had men like Fighting Father Duffy, the famous military chaplain, whom we remember. You may remember Pat O'Brien taking his part in the movie, The Chaplain of the Fighting 69th. You may have seen his statue on Times Square in New York City. Well, Fighting Father Duffy was also a very fine theologian who was on the faculty of St. Joseph's Seminary in Dunwoody in Yonkers, New York, for many years. And Father Duffy, while he was there, edited a theological publication called the New York Review. Very scholarly, very, very well done. He also taught theology to seminarians at Dunwoody, and he developed an exchange program with Columbia University, where the theologians of Dunwoody could go to Columbia and sit in on classes, and the undergraduates at Columbia could come to St. Joseph's Seminary in Yonkers and sit in on theology classes. You had in those days two publications like the Irish World, edited by Patrick Ford in New York City, the Catholic News, edited by the premier American Catholic historian John Gilmary Shea. You had prominent Germans like Arthur Proust, the somewhat conservative editor of the St. Louis Fortnightly Review. You had the more socially progressive Henry Spawnhurst, who became the president of the Zentralverein, a national federation of parish mutual aid societies that had its beginnings as early as 1855. You also had a great deal of anti-Catholicism to combat all of these success stories. You had, for example, in Clinton, Iowa, about 1887, the formation of an organization called the American Protective Association. We more affectionately refer to that as the APA. The APA had a phenomenal membership, and they promised never to vote for a Catholic, never to hire a Catholic when a non-Catholic was available, and never to join Roman Catholics in a strike. So there was indeed hostility, there was indeed bigotry. But we were not going to be dismayed by it, we went along. Remember we said a few episodes back that in 1789, John Carroll was consecrated the first bishop in the United States? Well, in 1889, 100 years later, we had a tremendous centenary observance, the centennial of the establishment of the hierarchy of the United States. This was a magnificent gathering of lay people and also of bishops and archbishops and cardinals from around the country. And once again, we show you a souvenir program booklet from the Centennial Congress held to commemorate the centenary of the establishment of the American hierarchy in the United States. And within this book, you will find position papers on things like temperance and prison reform and various areas of social reform with which we concerned ourselves in the late 19th century. This was a marvelous, marvelous organization of people, and it was a tremendous demonstration of the strength which the Catholic Church in the United States had achieved by 1889, when our hierarchy was officially 100 years old. Rather interestingly, there was another conference called the Columbian Catholic Conference, held in Chicago about 4 years after the centenary of the hierarchy. That was held in conjunction with the Columbian Exhibition in the city of Chicago. And there was a famous paper delivered at this Catholic conference by Rose Hawthorne Lathrop. She was the daughter of Nathaniel Hawthorne, the very famous American author. And Rose Hawthorne Lathrop said something very interesting in these days in this paper she gave. O woman, the hour has struck when you are to arise and defend your rights, your abilities for competition with men in intellectual and professional endurance, the hour when you are to prove that purity and generosity are for the nation as well as for the home. That's rather striking rhetoric back in 1891 when she said it, or 1893 rather. Today it would be interpreted in a very different way. But Rose Hawthorne Lathrop went on to establish the Hawthorne Dominican Sisters for the Care of Incurable Cancer. They are a magnificent congregation of religious women. And finally, now in these years of the Gilded Age, we want to talk a little bit about Catholic education in the United States. And certainly the man who was the foremost proponent of Catholic education was the Bishop of Peoria, Illinois, John Lancaster Spaulding. He was the nephew of Archbishop Martin J. Spaulding of Baltimore. He had been born in rural Kentucky, and he was descended from English Catholics who settled in southern Maryland several generations before him. John Lancaster Spaulding was himself a very brilliant man and a tremendous force, if you will, in getting other people interested in Catholic higher education in the United States. One of the people he influenced very much was a man whom we affectionately refer to as the consecrated blizzard of the Northwest, John Ireland, the Archbishop of St. Paul, Minnesota. John Ireland was so influenced by Spaulding and his views on education that he decided, I want to do something in the Archdiocese of St. Paul to see if I cannot enhance my Catholic schools. And John Ireland came up with what he referred to as the Faribault Plan. The plan took its name from the city of Faribault, Minnesota. John Ireland's idea was this. If I start teaching religion in the parochial school after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm not teaching religion at all during the school day, why can't I apply for state funding for parochial schools? After all, there's no religion being taught during school hours. It's all being taught after 3 o'clock. So he decided he was going to approach the state legislature of Minnesota with this idea, and he did. And believe it or not, Archbishop Ireland was very successful in the town of Faribault, Minnesota, and also in the town of Stillwater, Minnesota, in two parochial schools in those towns. Believe it or not, state funds were allocated for the running of parochial schools for 2 years. Now, what happened to Archbishop Ireland's plan? Well, it was ultimately declared unconstitutional by the Minnesota State Supreme Court. But imagine that he was able to get the funding for 2 years for the operation of his parochial schools in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was a very far-sighted man. He was a man who was, as we say, influenced by this great American Catholic educator, John Lancaster Spaulding. Spaulding had a tremendous influence not just on John Ireland, but his educational writings had an influence on many, many people of his day. So much so that Columbia University awarded Bishop Spaulding an honorary degree, and President Theodore Roosevelt asked John Lancaster Spaulding if he would not help out in the arbitration that was coming about and that was going to be necessary to end the very famous anthracite coal strike, which took place in the coal fields of northeastern Pennsylvania in 1902. There's an interesting sidelight to the career of John Lancaster Spaulding. When he was a very old man in Peoria, he was saying Mass in his cathedral there, the Cathedral of St. Mary's in Peoria, Illinois, and he had a young altar boy who I suppose might have been a little nervous. He was just a little fellow serving. And the great Archbishop Spaulding said to his little altar boy after Mass, someday you're going to grow up and you're going to be a priest and you're going to be a great man, or at least words to that effect. He predicted greatness for the little altar boy who was serving him in Peoria. The little altar boy was Fulton J. Sheen. So Spaulding was indeed a far-sighted man in so many ways. So these are some of the characters now. These are some of the personalities in religious life, in political life, in social life, that were distinguishing themselves in this so-called era of Cardinal Gibbons, the era in which the church came of age in the United States, the period of time in which we call the Gilded Age, the decades in which tremendous fortunes were being made, but yet also the decades in which many, many poor immigrants, many poor Catholic immigrants, in contrast to men of fortune, were pouring into the United States and were coming into a church which was strong, coming into a church which was vibrant, coming into a church which was very well adapted to take care of their spiritual needs and the needs of their descendants, those people in their families who would grow up after them. So we were really very well positioned. Intellectually, socially, maybe you could even say politically, certainly you could say spiritually, we were very, very well positioned to come into the 20th century. We were going to see revolutionary changes in the 20th century, ups and downs as you find them in every century, But by heavens, the church was doing so well in the United States of America as we conclude the era of Cardinal Gibbons, and as that same Cardinal Gibbons will now begin to bring us into the 20th century, where he will live for a good two decades himself. It is the story of American Catholicism in the 20th century, to which we will turn in our next episode. Thank you.